It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, you could soon be seeing some special labels at the store they say made in Wisconsin. We'll get the details on this new effort to promote state products.
But first, four states held their presidential primaries and caucuses yesterday: Mississippi, Hawaii, Idaho, and Michigan.
And there were some surprising victories and defeats as the polling numbers came in throughout the night. Clinton was projected to win Michigan and came up short. The win went to Bernie Sanders. And Trump is still in the game despite an aggressive ad campaign against him. He ended up winning three states.
Joining us now to talk about yesterday's results is Harry Enten. He's the senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time. Harry, welcome back.
Hello.
Well, how about Michigan? What'd you make of that?
Oh, boy. As you could tell, I was waiting to get the words out of my mouth. I couldn't even wait. We looked at the numbers, and this was the biggest primary error for polling since at least 84. And to be honest, based upon some new data that someone was kind enough to send me, I think that this primary polling error was even greater than the one I thought it might be equivalent to. So in well-polled contest, and this was a well-polled contest, the Michigan Democratic primary, Bernie Sanders, who was down by 21 points or so, and the average of polls ends up winning by two. It's the greatest error ever in presidential primary history.
Well, everybody's trying to figure out what it means. Here's a listen to what Bernie Sanders thought it meant. So he was talking in Florida while the votes were being counted there in Michigan.
What tonight means is that the Bernie Sanders campaign, the people's revolution that we are talking about, the political revolution that we are talking about, is strong in every part of the country. And frankly, we believe that our strongest areas are yet to happen.
Now, Sanders, Harry, lost in Mississippi, as everyone expected. But you wrote in your piece on looking at Michigan, Mississippi, and the road ahead, those southern states that Hillary Clinton had a big advantage in are pretty much done now. So Sanders is maybe right to say his strongest areas are yet to come.
Well, I would say Clinton's strongest areas are behind her, but that isn't necessarily saying the same thing as Sanders' strongest areas are to come. There are a number of states where Hillary Clinton should do well in that haven't voted in yet, mainly North Carolina and Florida, for instance, vote next Tuesday, where have a high African-American population. Florida has a very old population as well. Clinton does well among older voters. So I think, you know, look, Bernie Sanders deserves a lot of credit. His fans should certainly take a lot of heart in what happened last night, but he is still more than 200 pledged delegates behind Hillary Clinton. He has missed what we're calling his delegate targets. That is how well we expect him to do if the race was tied nationally. He is still well below his targets there. So, no, I mean, yeah, he could come back and sort of make this more of a contest. But remember, Hillary Clinton has a larger lead in the pledged delegate count than Barack Obama ever had during the 2008 campaign.
Let's look at a state like Ohio, where the polls, like Michigan, show Clinton pretty far ahead. Is it possible that there was something throwing off the polls in Michigan that might be true in another big Midwestern state?
Sure. I mean, I think Ohio is the most obvious example. I mean, you know, Ohio is just to the southeast of Michigan. It's an open primary like Michigan. It has a major metropolitan area, Cleveland versus Detroit. And the other thing that's going on in Ohio, like in Michigan, was that there were a number of people, anecdotal reports, who said, you know what, we think Hillary Clinton's going to win, so we're going to vote in the Republican primary, perhaps vote for John Kasich. And in Ohio, don't be surprised if a lot of Democrats do that, given that John Kasich is, of course, their governor.
So you mentioned that delegate count, and people are looking at Michigan saying big win for Sanders here, unexpected, outperformed polls. You mentioned that delegate lead, though. When all the dust settled, Clinton's lead after yesterday is bigger than it was before yesterday.
That's exactly right, because if you look at Mississippi, which no one is talking about Mississippi, I don't know why people aren't talking about Mississippi. Mississippi is a fine state, maybe a little shady of a history, but a fine state. And Clinton absolutely romped there. She got greater than 80% of the vote. She picked up well more than half the delegates. And because she did so well there, her delegate lead expanded. And that's the thing in Democratic primaries. It's not just about winning and losing. It's about how much you win by. Everything is proportional. A two-point win in Michigan is perfectly fine for Bernie Sanders. But if he can't hold Clinton's margins down in the states that she's winning in, all of this will be for naught.
So what was up with those polls? I imagine you and pollsters and the people who look at polls are going to be trying to figure out why the outcome was so different than the polls were saying in Michigan.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is going to be something, if you remember back in 2008 on the Democratic side in New Hampshire, there was a big polling error where all the polls said Obama and Clinton won. There was a blue ribbon commission that was taken up after that primary result. Don't be surprised if we see something similar here. But, you know, as the dust settles and we try and figure out what's going on, my guess, based upon looking at what we've looked at so far, is it's a confluence of events. It's an open primary. Maybe there were more young voters who voted in the Democratic primary than we were expecting. Maybe African Americans weren't as favorable towards Hillary Clinton, although they still were quite favorable as we were expecting. So it's a lot of things. Usually the answer isn't just one thing. And for all we really know, maybe there was one late surge of momentum for Sanders, but that's probably just part of the equation.
Before we move on to the Republican side, let's get into those superdelegates a bit. One of Sanders' main advisors was on NPR's On Point this morning saying these delegates, even though they've pledged, doesn't mean they have to stick with their pledge. If Sanders can demonstrate support, if he can keep racking up victories, they can, they think, persuade some of those to change from the Clinton to the Sanders camp. Do you see that as key to a Sanders strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that that is the least of his problems. If Bernie Sanders wins the highest number of pledged delegates, and it's clear that he has, those superdelegates are not going to stop him from getting the nomination. The only real case where those superdelegates may play some sort of role is if both fall short of the number of pledged number of delegates they need to win the nomination. But if Sanders is ahead, it's difficult to imagine that the superdelegates are going to say, you know what, no, we're going to take that away from him. It would lead to basically a riot at the convention.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538.com, looking at yesterday's results in primaries and caucuses. Let's go to the Republican side now, Harry. Trump picks up three. Cruz picked up a state. Marco Rubio.
Oh, boy.
The talk has been, okay, he'll stick it out, because why wouldn't he? He'll stick it out till Florida, his home state, his last shot there. There's rumblings now. People are saying, nope, don't even wait for that, Rubio. Supposedly some people inside his campaign are starting to think that. Does Rubio stick around for, what is it, just like a week away till Florida?
Look. Until he drops out, my inclination is always to think that these guys are going to stick in, especially because it's Rubio's home state. I'm not sure I believe some of the polls coming from that state showing Rubio well back, but there's no question he's trailing there. It's 99 delegates, and it's winner-take-all. If Rubio doesn't win there, it's going to be Trump, and that's a real question whether the other candidates would really benefit from Rubio leaving, but remember, there are other states that are voting on the 15th, including Illinois, including Missouri, including Ohio. If Rubio drops out, he makes it a much higher chance that somebody else could win in those states other than Donald Trump. So it's kind of a balancing act if you're against Trump. Do I want to try and stop him in Florida? But if I don't really have a good chance there, maybe I should cut my losses and drop out so I give the anti-Trumps a better shot in those other states.
But the establishment of the Republican Party, their only guy in that case is Kasich, I guess, or they settle on Ted Cruz, which from the outset, it didn't look like the mainstream Republican establishment wanted to do.
This is the most amazing part of this primary, in all honesty, is the embracing of Ted Cruz by someone by the name of Lindsey Graham, who had cracked jokes about Ted Cruz dying, and all of a sudden he says, nah, actually, I could be okay with him. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be very, very interesting to see what exactly happens after 3:15, whether there is a sort of crowding of sources to Ted Cruz. If Kasich loses Ohio, he's out, so it doesn't even matter. But if he wins Ohio, then we get into some tricky math of where the different anti-Trumps play well, and Trump may be able to simply win over a divided field.
As we said, Donald Trump won three of the four states available, and he started a campaign speech with a little math. Let's give a listen.
We started off with 17. We're down to four. Of the four, they're pretty much all gone, okay? Pretty much. They didn't do so well tonight, folks, okay? I'm not going to say anybody didn't do well. They didn't do well. There's only one person did well tonight, Donald Trump, I will tell you. It's true.
Harry, you talked about before Super Tuesday, Trump got about 34% of primary votes cast. After Super Tuesday, 34%. There's been a big concentrated fire at debates, ads run against Trump. I don't know if you've broken down the numbers yet. Is he still getting that 34%-ish zone?
He did a little better than that last night, mostly on the strength of how he did in Mississippi. But again, he's not getting a majority of the vote. He is getting a plurality of the vote. He's not getting a majority of the delegates. He got a plurality of the delegates last night. There are still a lot of signs that a lot of Republicans are very queasy about voting for Donald Trump. So we're going to have to wait and see what exactly happens when this field thins down. But again, I would look to 315. Let's see how the delegate dust settles in Missouri, in Illinois, in Ohio, Florida, North Carolina, and see where Trump is after that. Even if he wins Florida and Ohio, it's still not an easy road for him. So it's far from over, though. Good night for Donald Trump last night.
It was. You've been tracking his unfavorables, though. So there's clearly people who like him enough to keep him in the lead, keep him winning states. But those unfavorables here in Wisconsin, a recent poll found his net favorability rating at zero among Republican identified voters, worse among everybody. Is that something that could stop him in the primary or a big millstone around his neck in a general election?
Absolutely. I'll say two things. In terms of the general election, the ABC News Washington Post poll found that his net favorable rating was lower than any other political candidate in their entire history in their most recent poll. We're back to the beginning where his net favorable rating is awful, at least among the general public. In terms of the primary electorate, look at both the ABC Washington Post poll and the NBC Wall Street Journal poll. Ted Cruz beats Donald Trump in a one-on-one. Now, whether or not that actually bears out when it becomes that, if it does, I cannot say. But it is still a uphill climb for him, at least to be able to get a majority of delegates going into the national convention.
And that brings up the question of how this Republican primary comes out. Is it going to be one-on-one Cruz, say, against Trump? Or is it going to be the Romney strategy, if you want to call it that? Hey, everybody, stay in. Hey, all the voters, vote for anybody but Trump. Make sure he doesn't get a majority. We'll sort this all out at the convention.
It will depend partially on how Marco Rubio and John Kasich do next Tuesday. If Kasich loses, he loses Ohio. He has already said he's going to depart this race. That idea of trying to keep the ball away from Trump really only works in proportional primaries, which if it were the Democratic side, they would all be. But on the Republican side, we saw, for instance, in Idaho last night where Ted Cruz would have gotten a majority of the vote if Marco Rubio had not been in the race, but he instead fell short, only got a plurality, and therefore had to split the delegates with Trump. If he had gotten a majority, Cruz would have won all the delegates, and there are going to be a lot more states like that which have 50% rules to get winner-take-all. There are going to be more winner-take-all states going on forward, and a divided field against Trump does the Republican anti-Trump movement no good.
You do a lot of math there at 538, but you just don't have a lot of precedent to work with still on this one, do you?
Let's be honest. I just looked up in the database of multi-billionaires, or that's what he claims to be anyway, running for president, making remarks that offend some people. Turns out there really aren't many of those who have done so well in Republican primaries in history. So, yes, we're in uncharted territories here.
Well, looking ahead to Ohio and Florida, we've touched on them both a little bit. What are you going to watch for between now and then? What are you going to look for as the exit polls start coming out?
Well, I think the thing that we're going to look for is whether or not John Kasich is able to coalesce that anti-Trump vote in the state of Ohio, whether Marco Rubio has any good movement in Florida. And I'm hoping for a Missouri poll. If there are any pollsters listening, I beg of thee to please release a Missouri poll so we have some idea of what's going on in that state. It is, at the end of the day, mostly winner-take-all based upon the rules. And then in terms of the exit polls, late deciders, whether or not the anti-Trump vote is able to coalesce around one candidate. Yesterday in Michigan, which was a state where Donald Trump only got a little more than a third of the vote, the late deciders split pretty evenly between Ted Cruz and John Kasich, which basically ensured that Trump was going to win.
We'll leave it there, Harry. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every Wednesday to give us the latest updates on what's going on in Washington and on the campaign trail.
A new program from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation aims to boost products made here in the state. And you may soon see part of that effort at your local store in the form of a Made in Wisconsin label.
Kelly Leitz joins us now. She's a vice president of marketing for the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Kelly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what's the basic idea? Why did we pursue this new Made in Wisconsin logo?
Sure. Well, one of WEDC's strategic pillars is to promote the state's business climate in order to encourage business startup growth and attraction. And To do this, we introduced the In Wisconsin brand in 2012 to provide a platform for the many stories of business opportunity and success in our state. And at the time, I described the In Wisconsin logo as a simple idea with a lot of potential, and the Made in Wisconsin program is one of the ways we're fulfilling that potential.
And do you think that Wisconsin has a good reputation, both in the state and beyond, that this is going to be attractive to people?
That's a great point. We actually piloted the program with a number of companies who approached us and asked for something along these lines that they could put on their products. And in working with those companies, we developed a video and we asked them the question, you know, why is it important for you to put this on your products? And across the board, they indicated that saying made in Wisconsin is saying more than just where their products are produced. It really speaks to the attributes itself. And they stress that Made in Wisconsin communicates things such as quality and honesty and a strong work ethic that separates their companies from their competition.
So this is part of the idea here to create sort of a Wisconsin brand that different companies can attach themselves to?
Yeah, well, we certainly have a brand, and we're tapping that brand and allowing companies to kind of unify in their articulation of what Wisconsin means to their to themselves and to their customers. And like I said, they feel that by putting this on their products, it indicates that you know, it's a high quality product, that our natural resources are very high quality, and that our work ethic is very strong, and our workers are very skilled and innovative.
And are you also hoping that people will be encouraged to buy local, to keep money in the economy here in Wisconsin?
Yes, that's another facet of the program that I'll give an example of some companies we're working with. There's a company called Golden Calf, which makes calf jackets. Yes, calf jackets. And they serve the dairy industry, and they're one of the companies that approached us. And they had this idea that, you know, to say something's made in Wisconsin to these dairy farmers means something. And if they don't say that, the assumption is going to be that these are made overseas and they're not of the quality that the company is, in fact, putting out. So for them, the logo communicates that, yes, you are supporting a Wisconsin company, but it's over and above that, a very high-quality product because it's made with pride.
We're talking to Kelly Leitz. He's Vice President of Marketing for the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, talking about a new Made in Wisconsin label that companies can sign up to use. And let's ask about how they do that. Maybe there's a manufacturer out listening out there right now. Do they have to lay out a lot of cash to have the right to put this on their package?
No, in fact, the program is free, and there's a simple application process which asks you to provide basic information about your company and your products. We do a simple kind of background check, confirm that you are who you say you are, et cetera. And we ask that you attest to the fact that you meet the requirements of the various modified Made in Wisconsin logos that we offered. So it's not just Made in Wisconsin. We've developed logos that reflect different companies' production process. So you could apply for the Brewed in Wisconsin or Built in Wisconsin, Designed in Wisconsin. There's a variety of options for you to choose the best one that fits your company's production process. And you can access the application and get a description of the program at made.inwisconsin.com.
And you mentioned the calf jackets. Do you have a sense of other manufacturers who are interested in this and who this appeals to the most so far?
Yeah, that's a great question. We launched the program, and like I said, we kind of knew this would be a hit because we were getting regular inquiries along these lines. And we launched this program at the Manufacturing Matters Conference on February 25th. And on my drive back from the conference, by the time I got back to their office, there were four new applications that had come in just from those attendees. And since then, we've had 40 applications in the last couple of weeks. So there is a great deal of interest, and it's really across the board. I mentioned the calf jackets and the pilot program participants included Golden Calf, but also eBracket and Appleton, which is a tech startup. and a company called Power Test in Sussex, which makes engine testing machines. So that demonstrates, I think, kind of the versatility of the program, as well as kind of the geographic reach. There's interest from all areas of the state, as well as a wide variety of manufacturing and other types of companies.
Now, suppose, as a hypothetical, I don't know, an afternoon radio show wanted to make use of the Made in Wisconsin logo. I mean, can it be that abstract? Can not just manufactured products, but it's sort of a conceptual thing, like, I don't know, like a radio show?
Yeah, just as a for instance.
Yeah, we have an example of a logo that kind of fits non-manufacturing products. We have engineered in Wisconsin, designed in Wisconsin, invented in Wisconsin, and we could add to the list. This, I think, covers a lot of ground, but if we get inquiries about things that aren't included on the list, we can certainly consider adding those. Broadcast in Wisconsin.
Well, Kelly, thanks a lot.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
That's Kelly Leitz, Vice President for the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. He joined us to talk about the new Made in Wisconsin program. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Laundry, dishes, who picks up the kids after practice, communication, setting priorities, and of course, money. These are all some of the things that married couples might find themselves, at one time or another, arguing about.
And while kids, chores, and communication might be some of the most common arguments, our next guest found that disputes about money can be the worst of all.
Here with us now is Lauren Papp. She's associate professor and faculty director of the UW Couples Lab at UW-Madison. She studies intimate relationships and focuses on what they say about the behavioral, emotional, and psychological adjustment of people throughout their lives. She co-wrote a study a few years back called For Richer, For Poorer, Money as a Topic of Marital Conflict in the Home. Lauren, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you were quoted in a recent, and your research was referenced in a recent NPR piece on this topic. We thought we'd bring it on home to Wisconsin. Thanks for coming up to the studio to do that. So tell us where money fits in. So people say sometimes money is the most common argument, maybe not.
Yes. So in, there are some large surveys that find that money does emerge as the most common source of disagreements among couples. But our study was looking at not only how many conflicts do couples have and what are those disagreements about, but what are the conflicts like in couples' daily lives? And so we looked at not only whether or not the conflict occurred and what it was about, but also how was it handled. And in this study that you're mentioning, we found that money-related conflicts, compared to the other issues that Veronica mentioned, tended to be more difficult for couples, more intense, more significant to the relationship, and unfortunately, less likely to be resolved. So even though couples were reported using more problem-solving behavior and intentionally trying to resolve this issue, they weren't able to do it. The conflicts tended to be unresolved, and you can picture that frustrating cycle just building over time.
One question or one observation that might leap to mind is, well, of course, if people are having trouble with money, they're dealing with economic hardship, that's going to add stress. But it's not just, in your research, if I'm reading it right, it's not just people dealing with serious economic hardship.
Correct. So our study, other studies that look at the issue, we tend to include people from a range of economic or income backgrounds and control for that. So this is, you know, our study looked at simply the differences over money, controlling for what your actual income was.
Money isn't the most common argument, at least among the people who responded to your study. But as you say, it's often the worst argument. So why?
Right. Well, money is really important. The research is catching up to this, but therapists who have worked with couples, have long recognized that issues like money, disagreements over children, and conflicts concerning sex or intimacy are tied up with couples' power dynamics and a lot of feelings about equity and fairness in the relationship. If we think about those kind of hot-button topics, children, sex, and money, money is the one external thing that we have to face. You know, we're getting outside pressure about our financial situation. It's something that other people can see. So, it's an obvious problem or an obvious issue in a sense.
What kind of disagreements are people having about money?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we looked at things like expenses, decisions over what was purchased, where the money goes, how the money comes in. So just looking at kind of the cash flow of the house, what purchases are made and when, and are those acceptable purchases to the partners?
Talking to Lauren Papp from the UW Couples Lab, that's at UW-Madison, looking at money and arguments over money in among couples. She's done research on this, finds while money may not be the most common topic of contention within a couple, it's often one of the worst. It leads to the worst arguments between, say, married couples. You can join the conversation, by the way, at 800-642-1234. How has this played out in your relationship? Is this a common topic of discussion, of argument? Is it one of the worst arguments, points of conflict that you have in your relationship? How do you get this sorted out? How do you resolve this? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. So, Lauren, when you listed those three topics as among the worst, money, sex, and children, all three of those are things that people, A, may not feel comfortable talking about, and B, may come in with a bunch of implicit assumptions that they're not even conscious of. Is that part of why there's such hot-button things?
Absolutely. And particularly for money, we know that people, just as individuals, come into our intimate and our closest relationships with long histories of money. Whether or not you realize it, you've been learning about money for your entire life. How did you see money handled in your family growing up? Was it talked about at all? Was it talked about only in the context of a conflict or a disagreement? Was it only discussed when things weren't going well? So these are, long histories and long experiences with money that people bring into their relationship. So I think that's another reason why this just comes up for couples and can be harder to work through.
And you mentioned power dynamics. So I could see one spouse makes more money. So does that mean they get more say of the money? If they make different amounts, do they split it evenly? Do they somehow separate it proportionally? Are these things that come up as issues?
Yes, absolutely. And I think when people have ideas of mine or, my share or what I bring in, that's where, the money in the family or in the household conflicts with the relationship, because the relationship assumes and requires working together, connection between the partners. So the couples need to have a shared sense of what are our goals, what are, what's our approach, what's important to us, and the finances, the financial situation of the household, wherever the money is coming from, needs to line up with the couple's values.
And you also mentioned status markers, and this is something that I imagine has changed maybe over the last couple generations. There's the traditional male breadwinner, woman homemaker. Obviously, that has changed hugely over the years. Have our personal relationships caught up with that?
Yeah, so I think so. If we focus on couples who get married or are in committed relationships in the United States today, we are constantly seeking indicators or evidence that our relationship is fair, that we're in equitable relationships. And it doesn't matter where the money is coming from. There are decisions that need to be made. People like to feel like they're in a relationship with a partner, with their soulmate, with their best friend. These things require some equity.
We're talking to Lauren Papp, associate professor and faculty director at the UW Couples Lab at UW-Madison, talking about how married couples argue about money. And we want to hear from you.
When you first met your spouse, your partner, did you know how you were going to approach your finances? Did you have a plan? And was there a turning point in your relationship when money maybe started to become an issue? You can call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Again, that number, 800-642-1234. We're picking up our conversation with Lauren Papp, faculty director of the UW Couples Lab at UW-Madison, talking about how married couples disagree about money. And we want to hear from you on this.
Do you and your spouse or partner have conflicts surrounding the money, the finances? When did it start to become a problem? And have these been particularly difficult arguments? How did you resolve them? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Or hey, maybe you've got it all sorted out. It's all smooth sailing. Love to hear your story, too, about how that works. 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Anna on the line in Richland Center. Anna, hi.
Hi. I'm not married, but I, my boyfriend and I have been having money issues. He's been out of work for a while, and so when he needs money, he has to ask me. And then I become resentful, and then I think it's especially demoralizing to men to have to ask their girlfriend for money for everyday expenses. So it's been a source of contention, and it's really hard to deal with one person not having a job.
Anna, thanks a lot for that call and bringing up a lot of issues there. So there's a couple of things there. I don't know if you looked at only married couples in your research, Lauren, or married and committed couples, but maybe not within a marriage, and maybe without that assumption that, hey, now we're an economic unit.
Yeah. So while our study did focus on married couples living with children, so these were couples and families, we know that even research on newlyweds or committed couples in earlier phases of their relationship still list money as a high source of conflict. And in that, when we look at couples who are not living with children yet, that's where we do see finances and money issues coming up as the top one or two reasons. So it's an important time for couples to try and join together, look at their individual experiences and beliefs about money, and then in times of stress, try to help each other out.
And did this come up as an issue with the married couples you studied, that one is, as in this case, unemployed, and the other one feels like they're carrying the load, the other one maybe feels like they're not doing their part or resentful, that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So we didn't look at workers versus not, or employed versus not in ours. But these are, you know, still issues for couples today across relationship stages. So, yeah, it's important.
Anna, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Michael in Lodi. Michael, hi.
Hi. Yeah, my wife and I, we've been married 28 years, and for a long time, money was a source of conflict for us. But we, at some point, decided that we needed to separate our money. We're both employed and earned approximately equal amounts of money anyway. And so we have a joint account that we both contribute to for our common costs, you know, housing and things like that. And the rest of our money is ours, and we don't argue about money anymore.
All right, Michael, thanks a lot for sharing that. And let's talk about resolutions and the people you're researching, Lauren. A lot of people argue, but did some people find the light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, so I think if we look at just the broader advice and practices that successful couples engage in, we see it's not so much do you have a shared account, or, you know, do you have your own money? What matters is, what is the team perspective? What is the couple's perspective? You know, wherever we have our money and however we get to spend it or save it or whatever we choose to do with it, are we on the same page with that? And do we understand why we've made those decisions?
How do you get there, though? Because I think I read in your research that couples can work on these arguments. They can use positive tools to try to do that. And often that only makes things worse. So how do they get from there to that team approach?
Yeah. So I think these broader discussions need to happen outside of the conflict, outside of the conflict arena. So have time to talk about your approach with money, your background with money, your goals. Talk about that. Not when you're working through a conflict or a disagreement, but when you can kind of look at bigger picture issues. Once you are working on your team or your relationship approach to the money, then try and think of that bigger picture. This is an area where you need to understand where you're coming from and where your partner is coming from. So to the extent that both people in the relationship can understand, this is why I've made some choices that I have, this is why I have some of these financial practices, and understand that about your partner, hopefully it will make the relationship a safer place to have these potentially difficult discussions about money.
It seems like a lot of people may not do this at an early stage because they're like, oh, we're in love, we're soulmates, we're in the clouds. Are we going to get a joint bank account? Isn't necessarily the sort of romantic talk that people are going to get to early in the game.
Exactly. Exactly. And I appreciate the romantic viewpoint. But what our studies tell us is that this is an issue early on in couples' relationships, as people become more committed and more serious with each other, finances and concerns about spending rise to the top right away. One of the biggest predictors of newlywed marital unhappiness, and so there are newlyweds who become unhappy fairly quickly, and one of the biggest predictors of that is having debt, how much debt is brought into the marriage. And it's not just any debt, but we see that consumer debt, so debt related to credit cards, overdue bills, if that increases over the newlywed years, then relationship satisfaction declines. Other types of debt like mortgages, student loans, that type of debt doesn't have the same effect on our relationship. So we know that there are some, people can tell that there are differences in, you know, how you're spending your money, and that matters.
We see this as constructive debt, a mortgage, you get a house. The college debt, you've got an education, ideally a better job prospect. Mm-hmm. The credit card debt, people may not see that way.
Exactly, exactly. And that type of spending, that type of liability, takes a greater toll on the relationship.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Sherry joins us now in Amory. Sherry, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your story?
Well, our story is we're in our late 50s, early 60s, just got married a year ago. So that's adding an extra element because I am used to being independent. For 20 years, I was alone, you know, by myself. And my husband is not working. He is a carpenter and working on our own house. But it's been going on a year now, and of him just remodeling our house and not bringing any income in. So it's causing some insecurities because I believe my first need is security. Not necessarily financially, but just to be, you know, taken care of. That's why I wanted a husband at 57. I wanted to get married, you know, to have someone in my life to feel secure with. And I don't feel that with him because I don't feel a commitment on his part to provide.
Sherry, is it easy, if I could ask a personal question, how is it to talk about this stuff? Is it an easy conversation to have? I'm guessing
No. Probably
not.
No, because I do have anger and resentment towards him because I feel like he is just living his life, you know, doing his project on our home, not facing reality, and he likes it. You know, that's fun for him, is to work on carpentry.
Sherry, good luck to you and your husband. I hope you can get that sorted out. Apart from the particular details here, Sherry's story, I guess, is probably really common. Hard to talk about this stuff when people are coming at it from two different perspectives.
Hard to talk about, and you know, just the disappointment or the frustration that can come up when you realize, wait, we didn't have the same expectations. This, you know, we just have different views on what we thought we would be doing and receiving once this relationship became more committed or a marriage.
Thanks a lot for the call and good luck, Sherry. We're talking to Lauren Papp from UW-Madison about money and marriage, money in relationships, big argument starter, not necessarily the most common argument couples have, but often among the worst arguments couples have, Lauren's research has found. We'll go back to our callers now with Thomas in Eau Claire. Thomas, hi.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What did you want to bring up, Thomas?
All right. Well, I guess I am in a same-sex marriage, and my husband is quite a bit older than I am. And thank you very much for talking about this, because really the only thing that we ever fight about is money. Both of us have very good jobs. We both make plenty of money. So there's no issue with the amount of money that we have, but it really causes conflict in our relationship, and I'd like to know if there's any advice for that.
First, Thomas, I want to ask, you're not going broke. You've got plenty of money, both of you coming in. So what is the point of conflict?
It is the way we look at money. You know what I mean? You know, we have a good life. We have, you know, like I said, both of us have really, really good W-2 jobs. We do have businesses, and those, how we run them and how we handle money with the businesses in particular causes problems. But the whole way we look at money, from I view my credit score as important, my husband much less so, and that creates constant struggle for me personally. And it's definitely more on my side than his, I think.
Thomas, thanks a lot for that call, and good luck to you. So, Lauren, you were mentioning earlier, it's not financial hardship that's necessarily the problem. So it could be different priorities. Like, maybe one partner says travel while we're still young is a priority. The other one says saving for retirement is, and those are both valid arguments. but still arguments.
Exactly. This relationship just exemplifies it's not about the actual money a lot of the times. It's about personality. Are you a saver or a spender? Do you take risks? Are you more impulsive? Or do you want to save everything for the future, even if you have the money to spend now? So that was a great example of how, understanding the backgrounds, previous experiences in families or other relationships or as an individual, you know, how did you both get to that place of where you are now? Because what you bring to your relationship, that's the foundation for your future money discussions. So the more you can understand them, the better.
As we wrap up, and you've given pointed towards some advice as we've gone on, but from your research, from advice you've seen out there, what is a starting point for a couple to set those ground rules to talk about money?
Yeah, talk about money and understand each other's perspectives. Don't do that during the heat of the moment, though. If you have a specific money conflict to work through, focus on where the issue is and try and resolve that one issue. Then talk about these bigger picture discussions. Money itself can be very emotional. People can use money to buy things to make themselves feel better, to impress other people. Try and avoid those emotional uses of money in the process.
Lauren, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Lauren Papp. She's associate professor and faculty director of the UW Couples Lab at UW-Madison. You can read an article featuring her research on marriages and money by going to the Central Time Facebook page. About a year ago on Central Time, we talked to the inventor of the Lamely doll, an alternative to the Barbie doll. The inventor, Nicolay Lam, wanted to give kids a doll to play with that looked more like real women and could be purchased with accessories like stretch marks and zits.
The idea being that kids, especially girls, get unrealistic ideas about what women's bodies are supposed to be like if they only play, say, with a Barbie doll, whose proportions probably are best suited to the realm of computer generation. Here's Nicolay Lam.
You know, when I walk down the toy shelves, I kind of get the impression that it's like we should all look like supermodels, but maybe if there's just another realistic alternative, it's as if the wall would be saying like, yeah, it's cool to be a supermodel, and it's also cool to be just like a typical person.
He's got that boy doll in the works. And Veronica, back then you had asked him about the idea of maybe creating a boy version of his more lifelike doll.
To make a boy doll successful, it has to have like a really cool backstory. And, you know, that's the main thing I'm going to work on for the boy doll, you know, aside from obviously making it with typical proportions too.
And that new boy doll on the way, that creator says he may not have a six pack, but he has a fantastic sense of humor. He may not have the biggest biceps, but he has a big heart. A little bit of that developing story.
Are we talking about me or the doll now?
I don't know. I got confused as I read that.
Could be.
Yeah, this is is it billed as having a dad bod?
This one has a dad bod, which I don't think I quite have. Anyway, we'll be watching for the normal Barbie male version. Stick around, more to come on Central Time.